It also entails a lot of search and seizure questions that we won't get into tonight, but if you read the Guzman case and the concurring opinion, which just happened to be written by me, I'm not writing a book, I'm not plugging it. It was all concurred in this decision, but here are the facts of that case. I'm going to give you this to graphically illustrate why these words still mean. That's why it's a ruined hovel. At 1 a.m. in the morning in Lexington, Kentucky, officers were responding to complaint by a neighbor in the Meadowthorpe area of Lexington. Some of you may know that area. The neighbor complained of drugs and prostitution. She said she saw a black man and a white man go to Mrs. Guzman's apartment. While the police were there at 1 o'clock in the morning talking to the neighbor, they saw the black man walk down the steps. They stopped him. They interviewed him. They frisked him. He was clean. They went to the car. The car was clean. They let him go. Still had the white man up in the apartment and still had the woman up there. So they have nothing to conduct a search on, right? They have nothing. The neighbors complain. Prostitution, drugs going on here. She told two men going out, one black going up, one black, one white. The black man's left, clean as a whistle. They have no basis to do anything but do what? Knock and talk. They always go knock and talk, and that's exactly what they did. They went up to the second floor of that tenement, and they knocked on the door, and nobody came. They heard things rustling around inside. They knocked again. Nobody came. And finally, a man comes to the door. And he says, I apologize. It took me so long to get to the door, but me and Mrs. Guzman were having sex on the floor on a mattress, and we couldn't open the door for him. This is beginning to appear to be somewhat of a seedy place, isn't it? They open the door. Mrs. Guzman invites them in. They can't find the light. They finally find a lamp to turn on. She's laying on the mattress. She has no pants on. She puts those on underneath the blanket. She lets them come into the living room. They turn the light on, and there's a blanket. I know college students are going to be aware of this. There's a blanket hanging from a door blocking the living room from the bedroom. The officer says, anybody else here? And she says, no. They make a sweep. They go through the kitchen, they go through the bedroom, they come back around. And when they're going through the kitchen, they see in the sink a little spoon with some residue on it, cocaine. It appears to be cocaine. They come back out and they ask her, can we search the house? They've seen this residue. Can we search the house? And she says, what happens if I say no? Good question, right? We'll leave one of the officers here. The other one will go get a search warrant. She said, go ahead. So they search the house. They find some other drugs and stuff. Not a whole lot of stuff. It's a low-grade felony. They arrest her. They charge her with a drug case. And it gets up to us. And it turns on whether or not the residue on the spoon obtained the visual observation of the residue that the officer saw is evidence to provide probable cause to search. We held basically consent to come into the living room is not consent to go into the bedroom. It's not consent to go into the kitchen. It's not consent to go into the basement. And when you made the sweep without asking permission, you went into an area of the house you did not have consent to go into. And when you saw the residue on the spoon and you used that for probable cause, it's fruit of the poison tree. So you get another concept coming in here. And therefore, the search of the rest of the house is illegal. Now, we voted and we all concurred that it was an illegal search because it was through the poison tree. I wrote a concurring opinion. We didn't have to go this far. But I wrote a concurring opinion because there's something that was going on there in that place that is dangerous for law enforcement people to do. This was a low-grade felony. I think the girl was even probated. And I could just envision this case coming back around with a murder weapon involved, and we have to kick out a murder trial. And that's, here's the issue. What about when she asked that officer, if I don't give you permission, what are you going to do? And he says, I'm going to leave an officer here, and the other officer's going to get the... What has that officer done at that time? This is common practice. I know this, an old prosecutor. This is pretty standard. But what has that officer done at the time? He seized the apartment. The Fourth Amendment is against search and seizure. You can't seize the apartment unless you have probable cause. And then you can seize it for purposes, if you don't have exigent circumstances, you can seize it and go get a warrant. But if you've got exigent circumstances, you can seize it and you can search it at the same time. So, in this situation, had the officer asked her, can we search to make sure, I don't know if anybody's here, she'd probably said yes. Then seeing the residue would have presented them with untainted probable cause and exigent circumstances if they were going to arrest somebody. In this situation, it's hard to tell whether they were or not. And then they would have the right to search it without a warrant. Have probable cause and exigent. I wrote about this. And I wrote about this practice of seizing the scene and how dangerous it can be unless you've got probable cause. But I want to talk to you back on the William Pitt deal. I want to talk to you about this particular place and what our court said about it. And then I think that will answer the question as to whether or not the words of William Pitt are still well and alive today. Much is made by the Commonwealth of the blanket over the door to an interior room of the apartment as being some ominous sign of danger lurking within. For constitutional purposes, the covering is simply a barrier to an entranceway that is less attractive and substantial, perhaps, than a door, but was signaling an expectation of privacy. It may speak as much to poverty or want as it does to concealment. And our ancient Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution and Section 10 of our Kentucky Constitution does not discern between the rich or the poor. This apartment, its occupants, and their unseemly activities may not have measured up to an acceptable standard of decency. However, the stirring words of William Pitt, eloquently spoken more than 200 years ago, capture the soul of our Fourth Amendment. And then I pronounce that provision, that those words that I spoke to you earlier. So, even though this hovel, as such, was not up to common decency, it still garnered protection of the Fourth Amendment under both, not only the Fourth Amendment, but also the Tenth Amendment of the Kentucky Constitution. We've seen the Fourth Amendment evolve so much over time. And that's one of the reasons why our Constitution is still vibrant. Involving times, U.S. versus Carroll, 1925, automobile exception, and warrantless searches, probable cause and exigent circumstances. Charles Moreland is a senior status court of appeals judge in the state of Maryland. He's about 80 years old now. When I was prosecuting attorney, Charles Moreland was the guru of the Fourth Amendment. He traveled around talking about it. He came to Kentucky, the prosecutor's conference. He was the best I've ever heard. He had a very simple rule for lawyers and law enforcement. Very simple, how to involve the Fourth Amendment, interpret it, and the rule was this. Always get a warrant, unless you can. That has evolved as a rule to go by. And when I wrote the Guzman opinion, and when I wrote the Guzman concurring opinion, I got Charles Moreland on the phone, nice man. Told him he'd always been a hero of mine, always followed him. ask him, do you mind if I sent my draft opinion to him and give me his input? And I did. And he gave it his full blessing. I never got an A+ at Murray State. It pleased me any more than getting passing grade with Charles Moreland. He taught, basically the simple provision is, always get a warrant unless you can. Then we had the automobile exception, warrantless searches. How'd that all come about in U.S. versus Carroll? The United States Supreme Court said, wait a minute, this automobile is a little tricky. Stop somebody out here on the highway and you got probable cause, by the time you go get a warrant, they are going to be long gone. So if you got probable cause with an automobile, you've got exigent circumstances, because that evidence is going to be long gone by the time you go get a warrant. Became known as the automobile exception, the warrantless search, probable cause, and exigent circumstances on U.S. versus Curl. And then it came the landmark case of U.S. versus Katz. That was the expectation of privacy up until that time. We kind of thought of the Fourth Amendment protecting places instead of persons. This was a drug dealer that went to a phone booth, and they had tapped the phone booth. And they got evidence from his conversation on the phone, public phone booth. The U.S. Constitution said that he had an expectation of privacy, and said any time that you have a reasonable expectation of privacy, the Constitution Amendment 4 protects people, not places. What about trash? When you throw your trash out, when it's still sitting in the kitchen, or when it's on the back porch, or what about when you move it down to the curb? Fourth Amendment protection. You got a problem with abandonment, and then you got a problem of expectation of privacy. You really don't have too much of an expectation of privacy on trash once it hits the curb. But what about the back porch? We're going to be having, if you're interested at all, we're going to have a trash case on the abandonment and expectation of privacy next month for the Supreme Court, October the 18th, oral arguments at 9 o'clock. It's Commonwealth versus Owsley. And we got a trash case, just how far your trash has to go before police have to have a warrant in order to search it. And then we move down to the two latest Supreme Court decisions that really get into the modern age. City of Ontario versus Kwan dealt with a private texting on government time with a private computer. U.S. versus Jones had to deal with law enforcement putting a GPS to follow a drug dealer, suspected drug dealer, around. It was on for 28 days. Is this a search? Is this a Fourth Amendment invasion? Well, up the Supreme Court said in the Ontario versus Kwan case that it wasn't. But in the Jones case, it was. And when you read the Supreme Court opinions on that, and there were several, you really don't get a very good notion of what the law is now on GPS invasions. And you read the decision, Scalia wrote it, and he said basically the vehicle's effects, putting a GPS on there, was invasion. And he really didn't decide it. Some of the justices wanted to decide under Katz's expectation of privacy, which has been a very simple solution. I mean, think about it. Everybody has an expectation of privacy of their automobile. I guarantee if you're sitting in class and you look out and see your automobile parked out there and somebody's crawling around underneath it, they've invaded your privacy. You have an expectation of privacy in that vehicle. But the Supreme Court, if you read those opinions, and I don't expect you to, they're struggling with this new concept of what exactly, how far does it go, the Fourth Amendment protection. I want to venture an aside here. I don't want to bore you a lot here this evening. I will talk to you a little bit about the process. The Supreme Court, of course, made up of 9 members, and it's very difficult with the current Supreme Court and most recent Supreme Court of really knowing what the law is. If you have 9 justices that are writing 5 different opinions, then the law is a little bit shaky. That is why,
for the law to be clear. You tell me what the law is today on separation of church and state. I really don't know. Because every time a church and state case comes up for a Supreme Court, everybody's got a right. And everybody's got a different opinion. The result may be the same, concurring result. But there's no clarity. And I would submit to you that that's important. On our Supreme Court, there's 7 members, 2 less. But if you look at most of our cases, you'll see that very few of them do we write more than 2 opinions. Majority opinion, a dissent. Every now and then, a concurring opinion is written also. There is some clarity. And, of course, we try to work the consensus. And it's important that you know what the law is. And it's important that the Supreme Court is a trumpet that speaks with no uncertain term. And this is something that is going to be perplexing. You know, I want to editorialize a little bit here. Our Supreme Court justices are appointed, and now we claim to have a diversified court, but in reality, we have all former judges, all from Ivy League school. What's wrong with Murray State? They come together, and in many instances, it's not so much they don't have a common knowledge of what goes on around them, but I would submit to you, this is strictly an opinion, they may lack those people skills that some of those great justices of the past had because of where they came from. John Marshall, never been a judge. Rehnquist had never been a judge. William Douglas, never been a judge. Hugo Black, never been a judge. Earl Warren had never been a judge. You talk about some of the great titans of the past on our Supreme Court. They had been governors, they've been senators, they've been out there in the arena, and they knew to give and take and knew what compromise was and knew the importance of speaking with one voice and weren't afraid to compromise to get an opinion that you and I will know what the law is in the United States today and will be probably 75 years from now. I'll tell you how this works. We put up an opinion to the state Supreme Court. We vote on it. Somebody votes the dissent. I find out, what's the problem here? Why don't you like my opinion? I just don't like the result. They don't like the result, you know, there's not much you can do about it. I don't like this language. I don't like how you got there. I said, well, what would you like to say? Well, I don't like this particular sentence. It makes it look like you're doing this and that. I look at it. No problem. The sentence is gone. It's no big deal. Okay, I'll come aboard. Or I may go to another one that's a little bit tougher. This paragraph bothers me because I think you're saying this and that, and I don't think this is really the holding. You write what you'd like for that to say. We work together to get a consensus if we can without sacrificing principle. And that's why several of the opinions that I write on the Kentucky State Supreme Court are not as strong as I want them to be. We had a little Fourth Amendment case come up a year or two ago. It was a traffic stop. They had set up checking driver's license. The first car that comes up, the policeman's out there to check the driver. First car comes up, turns off a side road and tries to avoid it. He tells his buddy, go check that guy out. The guy goes and checks him out, opens the window, smells marijuana, stops him, frisks him, searches, arrests him. I thought it was a pretty good case myself. I mean, if you have a roadblock out there and all you got to do is show your driver's license and you're trying to avoid it, I think it's articulable suspicion. I thought it was pretty simple. I thought it was a good search. That case came down to be really, really close. I think we upheld that conviction maybe 4-3, and I had to work to get it. I had to water down. I got the opinion to write. I had to water down my opinion. I had to throw some stuff out. I had to do some qualifying. It's kind of like passing legislation. You have to give up on a certain thing, but it was very important to me that law enforcement had that tool, and we got it passed 4-3, but it's not nearly as strong.
It doesn't really say every time that a policeman sees this happening, he can go arrest him. I kind of blended it in with the facts of that case. This officer had been there a while. He had a lot of experience. Had to write in a lot of qualifying language. To me, it's just open and shut. But it wasn't to my other justices whose votes I needed. If we're going to get that to be the law of state and time. Well, I have been around and got to know Justice O'Connor. Nice lady. Really nice lady. And I've got to know and meet some of the others. Intellects of a tremendous depth, but at least one, and I won't mention, has the personality of a bowl of oatmeal. And I can see why he would never be able to persuade anybody to go along with him. I'm not saying they're all like that. I hear that. I don't know Justice Scalia. I hear he's a charming person. Thomas is a charming person. I'm not saying this to be critical, but I'm just saying we work hard. Because when a lawyer out there gets a case and it's 4-3, they can argue with judge, this case is going to may change the next election. We get a different makeup. And it does happen that way. But when you get a 7-0 or 5-2, it changes the mix. Speaking of the makeup of the Supreme Court, getting down now to the end so we can have some discussion. I got an interesting question for you. You got 27th Amendment to our U.S. Constitution, right? Got a question for you. I want you to think about this. And you might want to take it back and discuss it in class, whatever. If you had the power to write the 28th Amendment, what would you write? If you could change our U.S. Constitution, you could change it tonight. You write the 28th Amendment, what would it say? Oh, I know, that would be a great poll to put out. Can you imagine the answers that you would get? We'll do away with Walmart. We'll do away with this. We'll do away with that. We'll put the Ten Commandments up in the schools. We'll do this. Everyone would have their own political agenda to sharpen their knives on. I can imagine the array of things that you'd have written as 28th Amendment, some of which wouldn't be too surprising. It would probably scare us a little bit. Well, you didn't ask, but I'm going to tell you what mine was. You probably thought I was going there anyway. It has to do with the makeup of the court. It has to do with a Supreme Court that represents the wide spans of this great country. And if I could write the 28th Amendment, I would require that there be one Supreme Court justice from each of the Court of Appeal districts, except Washington, D.C. And the only reason I wouldn't put Washington, D.C. in there, that would make 10 districts. That way you would have justices on the Supreme Court from the Southwest, from the Northwest, from the Southeast, from the North Midwest. You'd have a great representation from all across this country instead of it becoming an elitist court. And I have to believe that we got many men and women capable from all parts of this country. I think it would bring something. It would enrich the court, its wisdom, its span, and also the respect that this country would have for the court. That would be my change if I had the 28th Amendment. Okay. I want to mention quickly a very important part of the Fourth Amendment. I'm going to do this real quick because you've been here a long time. Exclusionary rule. Exclusionary rule is so important. The U.S. Court in Weeks versus U.S. in 1914 applied exclusionary rule to the federal courts. Between then and 1961, 22 states, including Kentucky, had an exclusionary rule. But not until Mount versus Ohio, the U.S. in 1961, U.S. Supreme Court adopted the exclusionary rule so that the penalty of of trying to put in illegally obtained evidence was exclusion. And also in Mount versus Ohio, of course, it basically started filtering due process division of the Fourth Amendment to the states, and slowly but surely due process has become to mean more and more to our United States Supreme Court what most of the Ten Amendments say. Not all of them have been incorporated. Grand jury, for instance, requirement for a grand jury has not been incorporated into the states. Lastly, I said I would hit up on the Tenth Amendment. I want to hit it only briefly by telling you or saying to you that it's going to be interesting to watch during your lifetime if the Tenth Amendment, states' rights, is going to take on a new life, or whether it's going to eventually become like the human appendix. It's just there, dead. It was the most important amendment of all for the Founding Fathers. But through the years, it came in disrepute. Two things worked the Tenth Amendment over. One was the Great Depression, when the federal government had to show a really heavy hand. States couldn't take care of it on their own, so we had strong federal legislation, DVA and all the rest. And then in the days after the Civil War, especially in the 40s and 50s and 60s, it was used as a ruse, basically, to defend Southern racism and their racist policies. Not under a racist banner, but supposedly under states' rights. And it tarnished the idea of states' rights to a point that it still really never has recovered. Because we know that a lot of the Southern, deep Southern governors especially, always was talking about states' rights. Funny thing, their state never did anything about it. And to his credit, Governor Breath of Kentucky did pass the first Civil Rights Act in the South. So, what's going to happen to it? Will it just become an appendix? Or will it have a resurgence at some time when people get disenchanted with the strong powers and intrusions of the federal government? It'll be a story that'll be played out in your lifetime and be interesting to watch. I'll finish up on this statement, and then I'm going to open it up for questions. People don't have a clue what the state Supreme Court justice does. You people do. I walked into CVS over at Princeton a year or two ago. You remember when the Congress was all tied up in that budgetary cut and they were going to stay there the weekend? We were going to be able to have a budget if they didn't get it done. And they were all kind of clustered up all weekend, and everybody was wondering if they're going to get a budget before the federal government's going to have to shut down, all that stuff. And I tell you, I've seen that story before. It won't shut down, folks. You can relax. It'll find a way. You always do. I walked in the CVS store, talking to a friend of mine there. Well, she knew I was on the state Supreme Court. We've talked, exchanged myself. She said, "Well, you guys going to get this budgetary thing straightened out?" I said, "We guys, yeah. Y'all meeting this weekend? Have to get the budget straightened out so we don't close the federal government?" I said, "No. I've got a little bit of other things I have to worry about. I don't really worry about that." She didn't have a clue. People still ask me, "Well, do you live in Washington?" "No, I don't live in Washington." "This is a lifetime appointment?" "No, I just got through running for election, remember?" It's not a lifetime appointment. The big question, though, was, what do you think about the health care bill? I had so many people ask me about that. I know my congressmen haven't even read the health care bill. I said, "Look, ask Eddie Whitfield. That's his job. I don't know anything about it. And I'm not going to read it." And I said, "I still don't know anything about it. That's not my expertise. My expertise on the health care." Well, it's all passed now. The United States Constitution upheld it. And think what you want to do about it. It's over. Got health care, got Obamacare, and quite frankly, it won't affect me a whole lot, it affects a lot of people. But I will tell you this. If the Founding Fathers, that we talked about here,
1787. When they packed up their bags to leave Philadelphia in 1787,
had they been told that the federal government was going to be able to require everybody, to buy private insurance, they would have sworn that you were smoking something. Everybody but Alexander Hamilton. And he said, hallelujah. He would have been the only one applauding at that. But times change, and I'm just saying that our history is so diverse. Things have changed so much. It still remains today the miracle of Philadelphia. I've kept you here a long time. I apologize for doing that. Your time is valuable. I'll be glad, Bill, to answer questions.
Any questions?
I think everybody wants to go home.
Do you really think nowadays states should have rights for individuals, but our constitution, since we have a national constitution, should states have constitutions and have rights?
Well, it's in the constitution, the states' rights.
But should we amend that in general?
Well, part of the genius of this whole concept was federalism. And no, I think there's great strengths in having a strong state government. It's closest to the people. I think that was a great genius. And we're the one country that's unique in that regard, is that we had, and I think it was Justice Brandeis that spoke to the strength of that one time. He said the great strength of federalism is, when it's practiced, we have 50 bubbling laboratories of democracy out here. And there is a strength. If the legalization of marijuana in California, if it works, that's great. If it don't work, let them try it and see it, and we'll find out. When that issue came up, and this is very interesting, when that issue came up for the Supreme Court, the state of Alabama, which has the strongest marijuana laws in the country, the Attorney General of the state of Alabama filed an amicus curiae brief in the United States Supreme Court in support of California legalizing marijuana. Why? Because they're a bunch of fools, but they have a right to be a fool. And so we'll let them try it. I see states trying things, don't you? From time to time, you think, that's a pretty novel idea. That's pretty crazy. I wonder if that'll work. Probably won't. Well, let's see. That's the strength, I think, of federalism. And it's also still remains the government's closest to. Will it work? Of course, Alexander Hamilton, he actually would have liked to have done away with states. He couldn't say that because there was talk at the convention, some talk of redrawing boundary lines of states in order to take care of that representation thing. So yeah, I'm very much a believer in states' rights, and I've got a pamphlet back here on your way out. If any of you are really desperate for reading material, take that with you. I think there's great strength. But I'm just saying that the way we're going.
The civil rights laws in the 60s, kind of like the federal government came in, like U.S. Marshals, and came to the states and told them and forced them to do their, they wanted to do their own state constitution, but they wanted their own thing.
But there are emergencies, there's national emergencies for the federal government to step. Great Depression. States wasn't going to do it for civil rights, and we almost had a revolution over that. There are certain emergencies in times of war, federal government to step in. But it's beginning to take over criminal law. Used to, in fact, when John Kennedy was shot, I'm not even sure it was a state law, a federal murder case. Of course, it had been a state. Let me give you a good example. I've been on the Supreme Court about 6 months, and have fire in downtown Frankfort, not far from my apartment. Arsonist. I picked up the paper a few days later, and he'd been charged and was going to be prosecuted in federal court. I couldn't figure out what the federal crime was. So I went up to the Capitol, and we were just sitting around shooting the bull with the other judge. I said, what's this? They're prosecuting this arson in federal court. Nobody knew.
So I called Larry Cleveland, called with attorney, said, Larry, what's the deal on this? How is that a federal offense? You know what it was? Because that building that was burned was on the National Registry of Historic Buildings. Well, that's a little bit of a stretch, but you got the federal government prosecuting arson, and you got them in the criminal justice system. And I'm not so sure that's where we want our crimes prosecuted.
That's too much for the federal government. Should the states won't have any rights?
So the question is, though, that's where we're going, and it's probably irreversible if you don't like it. The question is it irreversible? And I think it depends a lot upon success that a strong federal government has. If it's successful, everybody will go along with it. If it's not, they won't. Any other questions?
Anybody else? Well, I want to thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thank you.